I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today on The Larry Mueller Show, and I believe X-rays were sort of an accident when they were first invented. I know that the X in X-rays stood for the unknown, as I don't think they were entirely certain how this technology worked when they first stumbled across it. X-rays, generally speaking, use radiation to penetrate through bodies and create images of internal structures. We think of it most commonly as our teeth and bones. We go to the doctor's office or we go to the dentist to find out what's broken on the inside or needs fixing. But X-rays and X-ray lasers have come a long way since their first invention, and our understanding continues to evolve in this technology. Here to help us understand it better is somebody who's on the cutting edge of X-ray technology. Uwe Bergmann is a professor of ultrafast X-ray science in UW-Madison's Department of Physics and a researcher at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in California. Uwe also worked as a staff scientist at the U.S. Department of Energy's SLAC National Accelerator Laboratory in Stanford, California. Do you have questions for our expert about X-rays and how they are being used to so much as see an electron move? And once we understand that, what does that mean about our greater understanding of our universe? From the tiniest little objects of our reality to the big picture of the world we're living in. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or sending us an email anytime to talk@wpr.org. Uwe, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, and let's start with how you see X-rays. You've been working with this technology for a while now, and I'm curious how you see X-rays as a tool that's used to help us increase our understanding of the world. How so?
Well, X-rays are really amazing in the following sense. They have a few properties which are very powerful. One of them is the one which we all know, which means that they can penetrate matter and we can get images, for example, the images of our body or the images of our teeth or even the images like when you go to the screening at an airport. Yeah. And to do that, we use very extremely high energy X-rays. By high energy, I mean they have a very short wavelength. That means they can penetrate very well. It doesn't mean that they are necessarily very intense. Intensities means how many we have or how focused they are. High energy means that they are very penetrating. So for all those practical applications, which most people are familiar with, including the popular culture X-ray vision of Superman, those are done with a really very, very penetrating X-rays. When you talk to researchers who do science with X-rays and use the most advanced X-ray machines in the world, we mostly use X-rays that are not as much penetrating. They're still penetrating, but they have other properties which really are very, very powerful. And the main two properties. One of them is they have very, very short. They still have very short wavelength. Mm-hmm. Why is that important? The reason why you cannot see, for example, a cell, right, the inside of a bacterium or a cell with visible light. There's the only reason for that is the wavelength is too long. It misses those small features. The wavelength of light is about, let's say, 500 nanometer, which is a half a micron, right? And the size of those objects are just smaller, so you cannot see them. X-rays have wavelengths typically of order some angstrom, and an angstrom is a tenth of a nanometer, so it's already much shorter, and then so it's basically 5,000 times shorter than visible light, and that means with X-rays, we can bring to light atoms and molecules, and that's one of the two properties which makes them very, very powerful.
That they have very short wavelengths, and you can see at the very atomic level using these short wavelengths.
Exactly. Exactly. So the most, I would say the most famous example was the discovery of the DNA by Rosalind Franklin's image and Watson and Crick. Obviously, they got the Nobel Prize, which was in the 1950s, right? That's already 75 years ago, 70 years ago. And they basically used the technique called X-ray diffraction or X-ray protein crystallography, which so they make copies of molecules and then they scatter X-rays from them. And by reconstructing those measured images, they can then reconstruct the molecular structure of those proteins. And they can do that with a basically with a very high resolution. So that means we can really see where each of the atoms is sitting in a big biological molecule. And that's how they basically discovered the double helix structure of the DNA. I like that example because it really opened, you know, it really showed the immense power of X-rays, right?
Uwe, how are some of the ways that you have used X-rays in the past? What are some of the things that you've looked at and researched prior to your most recent work?
Yes. So I have, thank you for that question. So I could give you a long answer, but let me just focus on a few. So we have used over, I have used since I started my research in, you know, in the late 1980s and then 1990s. We have used powerful X-ray machines called synchrotrons. These are large round accelerators, and they produce very intense and focused streams of X-rays. And we have also used them in the similar way as I just described in terms of diffraction. But I'm mostly an expert on a technique called X-ray spectroscopy. So spectroscopy comes from the word spectrum, which is like the spectrum of a rainbow, for example. These are the different colors of the rainbow. And we use the different colors. We use X-ray color, so you cannot see them with your eyes, but you can make them visible in a detector. And we use these spectra to understand not just the structure of proteins, but we even look a little bit further inside. So, for example, in the case of if you talk about a big a protein structure, you are interested in the overall composition. But then if you want to, if you're interested in even more details, you can zoom in on a specific element, let's say an iron or a manganese metal, which is inside one of those proteins. And you can then test the surroundings, the intimate surroundings of that atom with even more precision. And you do that by spectroscopy. We have also, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to take a step back and go through that a little slower for myself because it's your focus. It's X-ray spectroscopy, and it is using these very short wavelengths to look at the atomic levels, but what you are seeing as results ends up being a spectrograph of different, I wouldn't say colors because they're not necessarily viewable by the naked eye, but wavelengths that would come up as visual wavelengths is that correct?
Well, the wavelengths, they are, yes, it's correct that they're wavelengths. They're not visual. We visualize them.
Okay.
Right? So they're not visual in the sense that our eye can only see wavelengths of, let's say, 400 to 700 nanometer, right? These wavelengths are angstrom, but we can bring them to light because we can record them, and then we can visualize them, and we can actually plot them in as a like in a graph, or we can plot them with different colors. We have all kinds of ways how to bring them to light. But what is important is that that what is contained in these so-called spectra, right, which is a really kind of an abstract word. I appreciate that. But what is contained in the spectra, when you do the interpretation, you can actually see how the atoms and molecules, how they are individually arranged and how they are talking to each other. And that makes this technique called X-ray spectroscopy very, very powerful. It's a very powerful technique.
So you can see not just at the atomic level, you can see interactions at the atomic level. But you've been using two of the fastest X-ray lasers on Earth to come up with your latest science. And the published paper that you have recently published seems to suggest you have stumbled across something that is getting international attention now. Tell us a little bit about what it is you are researching and why your most recent discovery is getting so much attention, Uwe.
Oh, thank you for that question. So, yes. So let me just go back to.
Yeah.
So we, as scientists, we have used these synchrotron sources, right? These, which are also very large accelerators. And in fact, in Wisconsin, in Stoughton had one of the first synchrotrons in the world, and was operating it until 2014. It was a very successful program. And there's another very large one at Argonne National Lab outside of Chicago. It's the largest synchrotron in the United States. So these are powerful X-ray sources, and they are used internationally. There are many of those around the world. And in 2010 or 2009, a new form of X-ray sources came to light. And these are called X-ray free electron lasers. I'll drop the word free electron just to keep it short. So we call them X-ray lasers. And these X-ray lasers are even more powerful than synchrotrons in the following sense. They make pulses which are, first of all, more intense, much more intense, up to like a billion times more intense. Mm. And they make pulses which are very, very short. So these X-ray lasers who started basically in 2010 or 2009, and they have been around now for about 15 years or so, and there are only 6 machines around the world which make such X-ray laser pulses. They are now about 1,000 times shorter than these pulses from the synchrotrons, and they are on the time scale of typically like 10 femtosecond. So now, if you ask, oh, what's a femtosecond?
Yes.
A femtosecond is a millionth of a billionth of a second. So which is
it's an instant.
So it's short. It's very short. It's like basically 15 zeros and then comes the one. That is a femtosecond. And why are femtoseconds interesting? They're interesting. And by the way, I'm not yet at our research. So our research comes next, right? So I'm just telling you what these new X-ray lasers have been able to accomplish, and they really have caused a revolution in X-ray science. Right?
This is the setup here, because we started with the synchrotron X-rays and how they could accelerate in a way that allowed us to go even further, even smaller, even faster. But then in an almost exponential way, these X-ray lasers that you're now using, Uwe, seem to be even smaller, even faster, down to what, you know, the rest of us would consider a mere instant. You're able to capture what's happening at a atomic and even potentially subatomic level.
Exactly. And as I said, I'm still setting it up because I'm not yet at our work. So let me talk a little bit about these X-ray free electron lasers first.
Uwe, I'm going to stop you there because I have a caller here who wants to chime in, and I want to get to that before we get to the breakthrough research that you are, you know, in the process of uncovering and just recently published. Let's go to Guy in Neillsville first. Guy, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I work in a medical field, and I attended a webinar about 2 weeks ago. And on that webinar, we were talking about a virus and how it infects cells and how it binds to a receptor. And that receptor also is an amino acid transporter. It's kind of interesting. But they were talking about how tightly this virus binds to that receptor. And they showed an image of the receptor site with the virus binding. And they said it's so detailed, it was like a photograph. Hmm. It was 12 hydrogen bonds. And, you know, having gone through chemistry back in the 1980s, you know, I heard you talk about the DNA. But to actually be using this to look at interactions, biological interactions at the atomic level is just totally amazing. And I wondered if you could comment on that image, that sort of image.
Uwe?
Yeah, thank you for that question, or for this comment, actually. This is exactly, those images are, at the moment, they are most likely have been produced by X-rays, by these synchrotron X-rays. And there's another technique which has now gained a lot of power in the last few years. It's called electron microscopy. And electron microscopy also these electrons in the microscopy also have very short wavelengths, similar to the X-ray wavelength. So that technique has been coming up. But the largely dominant technique over the last 50 years to uncover exactly the kind of information our caller just said is from synchrotron radiation facilities. And there have been 100, I think up close to 200,000 protein structures have now been solved with these, with that X-ray technique, with the same, in, generally speaking, the same X-ray technique that Rosalind Franklin and Watson and Crick used in the 50s, just with much more powerful X-ray sources. So with much, and the tools have evolved, and they are extremely powerful methods for doing that. So thank you. That's a very good example.
Yeah, I appreciate the call, Guy. And Uwe Bergman is our guest, professor in UW-Madison's Department of Physics, researcher at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, and published a recent study that in part was done here where I am at the UW-Madison campus into what could be some of the fastest, most intense X-rays to capture the shortest pulses of an instant that we have seen to date, and what that mean for our understanding at the subatomic scale, at the fastest points of what we know to be speed as it stands. What do we find when we're on the precipice of this new technology? That's next. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to WPR News. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and coming up afternoon, the weather guys are back. Steve Ackerman and John Martin join us to help explain our air quality, our heat indices, and what the heck's happening with this Wisconsin summer. We'll be answering your questions as well today afternoon here on the Larry Mueller Show. But right now, we're talking to one of the scientists who apparently has generated the shortest pulse of high-energy X-rays that we have seen to date, using two powerful lasers to stimulate inner shell electrons. And these inner shell electrons, closest to the atomic nucleus, at the fastest rates of speed we've ever seen, in a way that could allow us to see for the very first time electrons dancing. Uwe Bergman, our guest, professor of ultrafast X-ray science in UW-Madison's Department of Physics, where he teaches, and he also is a researcher at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. And I apologize for the big buildup, Uwe, but I wanted to understand it better before we got into it. Your research, your published paper, and what we are finding with the strongest pulses at the fastest speeds we have ever used these X-ray lasers with before.
Yes, thank you. I really appreciate it. And I also want to thank the question of the which we got. So if I can go back to the X-ray free electron lasers, because those are needed to do the research which we did. And I mentioned before the break that we, with these X-ray free electron lasers, we can make pulses which are a few femtoseconds long. And so this is a few millionths of a billionth of a second. And that time scale is important because that is the time scale of chemistry happening. And what these X-ray lasers have allowed is when you have, let's say, a chemical bond forming. So you have a reaction, a chemical reaction, for example, CO oxidation. So you want, in a catalyst of a car, for example, you want to remove the carbon monoxide and turn it into carbon dioxide in a catalyst. The real process happens at a very fast time scale. And every real process, all the processes in our human body happen at, if you want to go really into the atomic picture of a chemical reaction, it happens very, very fast time scale. And with these free electron lasers, X-ray free electron lasers, we have now been able to access that time scale, how a bond is formed and broken, how let's say, a spin, which is another property of matter, is flipped from one side to the other. But it is still not the time scale which I'm talking about in our latest work, because that's another 100 times faster than that.
Wait. So you talked before, Uwe, about how we weren't able to originally see a human cell because we didn't yet have X-rays at a short enough wavelength. But now we can actually see the elements changing in front of us with speeds, with the current speeds and wavelengths of our X-rays. But you're saying now that you've gone 1,000 times faster than that even?
Well, yeah, I would say 100 times.
100 but, times.
I don't want to exaggerate, right? We are, it's about 100 times, but we are in a new time regime. Yes. So with the X-ray lasers, we have now been able, for example, if you go back also to the question from the caller, I'm part of collaborations which have actually done such work. We can now look at these, let's say, these proteins, these large molecules, and we can see how they change. For example, we are interested in studying photosynthesis. How does sunlight split water to produce oxygen, the oxygen we breathe? And we have now made movies where we show that with this exactly that X-ray technique on the atomic level.
You have showed, wait a minute. You have showed visually visual representations of the literal chemical reaction that is photosynthesis.
We have been able to do that in the last, over the last 10 years, yes. but that is, so that is not, this latest discovery is goes one step further, okay? So do you want me to talk a little bit about the latest stuff?
Oh, yes, right? please. Because in my mind, Uwe, I'm thinking, well, then what's further than that? I feel like we figured it all out. We can rest on our laurels now. We've seen how photosynthesis works. We're seeing how electrons can move between atomic particles. What more do we need to see, and what did you find?
Okay, so, well, first of all, we are scratching the surface. Let me be clear about that. I mean, life is so incredibly complicated. I mean, it is so complicated that it's mind-boggling. And we are just using not even most complicated reactions which we understand, but we have a path. So that, I think, is really important. We have the tools now to really look into the world on that level and on that time scale. So in our latest work, idea, if you want to call it, or we wanted to see whether we can use these super powerful pulses, which come from an X-ray free electron laser, which is a large kilometer long, big accelerator. And we said, can we make our own little atomic laser pumped with this large laser? And this work has been shown about 10 years ago or so, that it's in principle possible. And we have started to do some research with that. So we put in, let's say, a manganese foil or a copper foil, and we hit it with this very hard, very powerful, intense pulses. What happens next is that the foil itself generates its own inner shell atomic laser pulse, and we were using those pulses to study like the properties of the materials, and we were just interested to see what comes out. What we found, and it was really a little bit accidentally, that we drive it very, very hard. So if we crank up the intensity to the absolute maximum, and let me tell you how high that is. We have, at the moment when this X-ray free electron laser hits the sample, we have the same intensity as if we would focus all the sunlight which hits the Earth to one square millimeter. it's an insane amount of power density. Like it's 10 to the 20 watts per centimeter square. It's like an incredible power. But what happens at that instant, we generate a strong lasing event inside the sample. And when we looked at what comes out, we were surprised because the pulses didn't look like what we expected. They were much broader. By broad, I mean they had more X-ray colors in them. Huh. Right? Normally, we would have expected, let's say, to have a certain range of X-ray colors. But what we found, they had like 5 times, 10 times as much X-ray colors. And we said, where do these X-ray colors come from? They are not in the sample. There is no transition. There is no atomic transition in the sample which can generate these colors. And what we found out from finally understanding it with using simulations, which were developed by my colleagues in Hamburg, some of our collaborators, and then implemented by one of my postdocs, Tom Linko, who is actually also the first author of the paper, we these broad colors indicated that our pulses were even shorter, even 100 times shorter than the ones we pumped it with. Because, and that goes back to Heisenberg almost, there is a relationship. The shorter a pulse is, and by the way, in optics that is well known as well, the shorter a pulse is, the broader, the more colors it has. You cannot have a very short pulse which only has one color. If you make a pulse extremely short, it gets broader and broader in colors. It has more and more colors. And what we have discovered, that some of our pulses were 60 to 100 attoseconds, and that attosecond is 1,000 times shorter than a femtosecond. So they were the shortest pulses with hard X-rays ever produced. The world record, you can look it up on you can just type it in, and AI tells you it's 43 attoseconds, but that's not for X-rays, that's for ultraviolet light, right? Okay. Or in extreme ultraviolet light. We are much shorter in wavelength, so we are about, you know, almost 100 times shorter, so in wavelength. And so these are now the shortest pulses which have ever been made. Yeah.
So you're using the shortest pulses, the fastest X-rays, but you found results that you weren't expecting and had to bring in a what it sounds like an international team of scientists to help you understand what you'd actually done with what appears to have been, a focused energy beam that is on par with the sun itself. But you did not expect these samples. And, you know, what it reminds me of, Uwe, is it reminds me a little bit of the way X-rays were invented in the first place, that you got results that were surprising to you, weren't entirely sure where they were coming from, but may have led you to a whole new frontier of understanding X-ray lasers and lasing.
The discovery of X-rays by Röntgen, like, that was a earth-shattering event. I don't think we are on par with that, but... But we are happy to be able to. Actually, it took us really 5 years, and I mean the teams on these X-ray laser experiments, right? Those are large teams to start with, and we had collaborated the person who has developed the theory, the group Nina Noroing and I. We had collaborated already for quite some years. The theory was not in place, so they had to develop actually a three-dimensional theory because the effects we saw could not be simply explained like by just simulating the forward direction. We had to add the all three dimensions of the propagation of the light in the sample to come to this result. So that took some time, and yes, you're right. We were surprised, but I should point out this same phenomenon which we saw was also, and this is kind of makes it a historical circle, it was also discovered already 70 years ago before the laser. So before the laser was discovered, Townes and Ortler, Townes is the father of the laser, right? They discovered with microwave, they discovered a phenomenon called Rabi cycling, and that is the phenomenon which we now have observed with X-rays. So they never thought, no one ever thought at the time that you will ever see such a thing with X-rays, right? They were happy that they were able to see it with light. And so that has led to the development of lasers, right? And lasers are now everywhere. They're extremely important. But we have now pushed this to X-ray vision. So we now have these very, very powerful, short, extremely short pulses with X-rays.
Uwe Bergmann, our guest, professor in UW-Madison's Department of Physics and researcher at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, talking about his work with the fastest, strongest lasers we have ever seen and how they have led to a whole new frontier of X-ray laser technology and what the implications could be going forward. I want to invite you to our conversations with questions you may have about Uwe's work. 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us. Talk at WPR.org. That's talk at WPR.org. So you use these X-ray lasers to shoot like magnesium or copper, and you shoot it with what is basically a focused laser beam of the sun itself with its intensity, and you do it at such a small amount. But when you do it, as I understand it, Uwe, and I'm trying to think it through here, the pulses that that you are shooting at the copper or magnesium or whatever your element is, well, there are pulses that emanate inside these elements that are even shorter than the ones that you pumped them with. And the output is, what you visualize as a result, is more colors than you would have expected in the first place, which led you to try to come up with a whole bigger understanding of what's happening at our smallest levels of reality. Is that about right?
Absolutely. You got it 100% right.
Yes.
And in fact, the it's not magnesium, it's manganese, but I mean,
okay,
it sounds
thank
great.
You.
So manganese and the another important thing is, because our pulses are so powerful, I mean, each time you shoot the foil, you basically make a drill a hole in it and make a big crater, right? So the thing basically explodes, and so you have to move the sample quickly to the new spot. So we basically, when we do these experiments, we basically perforate our sample. So we look afterwards, we look on a microscope, we have like a perfectly perforated sample afterwards, because each single shot smashes out all the atoms, and they get sprayed all over the hutch and our collaborators in Japan and at FLAC, where we do this experiment at Stanford. They're sometimes not happy about us, like, polluting. So we need to make, like, a little chamber to capture all this debris which we are causing when we hit the sample. And yes, so in the sample, a second pulse is generated, and that is the utter second pulse.
Yeah.
Exactly correct.
So, but what is creating that second pulse that seems to be, I don't know, generating some energy from your original X-ray laser?
So yeah, so the way how it works, in a sense, it's a little bit like so we come in, let's say our original X-ray laser comes in with one color,
yep.
Right? And it has to have enough energy to remove those inner shell electrons. And then our secondary laser, our other second laser, shoots out slightly redder color. For example, In the analogy of visible light, and again, I should stress, X-rays don't have colors, not for the eye. We just use the word. We come in with a bluish color with femtoseconds, and we hit the copper or the manganese, and we come out with a reddish, more reddish color with attoseconds. And we have a spectrometer where we can actually separate them out very easily. So we can see only, we are only interested to see the little bit more reddish X-ray pulses, right? And because those are these extremely short X-ray pulses.
What are the ramifications of this breakthrough in using X-ray lasers? What has piqued your curiosity about what you may find now with this technology, Uwe?
Well, thank you. I think this is a very important question. I think we can move the field forward in my opinion, important directions. And I should point out, a lot of work is also going on with these attoseconds. I mean, it's a whole field now. In fact, the Nobel Prize in Physics 2 years ago was awarded for the discovery of attosecond pulses, and you can check it out. So in the optical regime, right, and in the also ultraviolet regime, attosecond pulses have become a thing. Right, it's a whole new field of science which is taking on. It hasn't been possible with X-rays, and it hasn't been possible with shortwave like X-rays, the ones we have, and that's what is exciting. So we can now enter this field of attosecond science. So what is happening at that level? First, I mentioned like a bond, a chemical bond is formed and broken. That's femtosecond. So that's 1,000 times slower, or 100 times slower. Attosecond is basically, what is a bond? When I draw a molecule, I just draw like electrons and I draw like atoms, and But that's not how reality is.
Right.
Because electrons are not circling in orbits like the... Some people say, oh, the electron is like the Earth circling the sun. No, it's not. It's completely different. It's quantum mechanics, right? It's a cloud. It's a delocalized cloud. And with this utter seconds, we can look inside that cloud now. We have a way to see actually... To see what we mean by when we say it's a cloud. And I think that aspect is very exciting.
So we have gone seeing the chemical bonds at our smallest atomic level to now with this attosecond high-energy X-ray lasers to seeing what these bonds actually are. Not just the cloud of electrons that surround a nucleus, but the instant that stops them in their tracks so that you can see the direction, the path that the electrons are taking over?
Exactly. So, for example, let me give a simple example. If you take a benzene ring, which is made out of six carbons, right? And if you would ask a chemist, what is that? Well, he said, oh, these are all delocalized electrons. Mm-hmm. So you can, at any given time, you look at them, they're all over the map, right? And with these utter seconds, you can say, no, actually, they're not. We can actually tell you where they are at even shorter times, because we have always assumed that at this short time scale, it all averages out. But now with these utter seconds, you can start to finally look inside of that.
Oh.
And that gives us new understanding about what is actually a chemical bond. And one really famous example is water, right? Water has a hydrogen bond, and we do not understand it because water is such a mysterious liquid. It has so many unusual properties, yet everyone uses it every day. We drink it. I'm drinking it right now. And the reason why we haven't really fully understood it yet is because we don't understand how the bond, the hydrogen bond is not really fully understood. And I believe once we have this utter second science, we can answer such questions, which are really absolutely fundamental to our understanding of nature and our understanding of life. And chemical reactions.
Uwe, if we can understand those bonds, then in ways we can start to think about how we might manipulate them to, say, desalinate water and provide fresh water for the entire globe. I mean, the ramifications are infinite and probably not even well considered yet, because what you're talking about would have seemed absolutely impossible just decades ago. So now we're changing the entire way we think about the smallest and shortest levels of our reality and how they comprise what we're living through today. It's fascinating. And I want to get to the callers here at 1-800-642-1234, where Alicia and Racine is standing by. Alicia, good morning.
Hi. I just caught the end of this, and my mind is kind of reeling right now. But, I mean, this is something that I'm wondering if it could create a whole new theory, like, you know, blow string theory and quantum mechanics out of the water, and even more simple things like laser surgery or whatever. I mean,
right?
Like, where do you want to go with this? Like, are you trying to create a whole new theory of reality with this?
Well, you know, there have been some big questions about the quantum theories of our physics. So let's ask Uwe Bergmann what this could mean for the actual theoretical aspects of our reality.
Yeah, thank you. It's a really good question. So we do string theory. I mean, first of all, string theory is a complicated topic because it's very difficult to test. But this is not the reality. So in order to get to those questions, you need to have much, much higher energies. You need to go to like a CERN particle accelerator and look on the inside, let's say, of a quark or a proton, etc. So we are not in the field of high energy physics, right? We are in the field of chemistry but quantum mechanics, right?
Yeah.
And I think the point that you mentioned, quantum mechanics, is a good one. Because one of the really interesting things I'm very excited about with this process which we are using and have discovered, we now can also consider making entangled light with X-rays, and that means we can do so-called quantum optics and quantum information. So there is a really good chance that I mean, and that has been currently pursued with a lot of my colleagues actually at Wisconsin and other universities are pursuing that. You might have heard of it. It's a new field called quantum computing, yep. Right? And they're using, so it's all done with visible light and all kind of different approaches. And there is potentially a way to use X-rays to look into such quantum entanglement. And I think that is a very exciting direction which this research could potentially go in the future.
Alicia, I'm so glad you asked. Thank you for calling. Uwe Bergmann is our guest. Recent published study with some support and help from scientists around the world have found that we may begin to understand not just the chemical bonds that create our reality, but how those bonds operate, how they move in what we would consider to be an instant. But our physicists are not getting down to even shorter periods of time with even stronger X-rays and what this may mean for our understanding and ability to improve our reality. Uwe Bergmann's professor at UW-Madison's Department of Physics, researcher at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, and he continues to answer your questions next here on The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is WPR News. Tomorrow on The Larry Mueller Show, we take a look at the new book, Piracy on the Great Lakes, True Tales of Freshwater Pirates. Also, take a tour of the planned city of Greendale and talk to the editor of Lake Superior Magazine, all coming up tomorrow on The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Larry today. And our guest this hour, Uwe Bergmann, professor in UW-Madison's Department of Physics and researcher at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, who's getting international notice right now for a recent paper he published, which takes a look at some of the strongest lasers on Earth being used in the fastest instance that we've ever used them before, and finding out at the very molecular level, not just the chemical bonds themselves, but how the bonds are created and destroyed in what you and I would consider an instant. I want to invite you to the conversations. Your questions have been great so far. 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org. Let's go to Carolyn LaCrosse next. Carolyn, good morning.
Good morning. I had a question. I was wondering if this discovery could deconstruct the chemical bonds in PFAS, and could we use this to take all that PFAS pollution out of our water?
Carolyn, thank you so much, because Uwe, I believe you've done some work with lasers and X-rays and artificial photosynthesis before. You mentioned that we do not understand water because of our lack of information about what these chemical bonds actually are doing. So tell us, would PFAS cleanup be something that we could see as a possible application of this technology?
Can you say, I'm not sure I understand what is PFAS? Is that
forever plastics that have seeped into our water supply, and what we're going to do about that in the future?
Okay. Yeah. Well, the techniques we are using are not, I don't think you would use any of those tools to do the cleanup, but understanding, let's say, if one were to come with a chemical way of purifying water from microplastics, right? And by the way, a lot of research is done in how one can purify things and remove things and add things. The understanding of how such a process would work on the molecular level, right? That could be interesting for maybe not our other second laser pulses, but in general for X-ray lasers, and there could potentially be some light shed onto how such reactions happen. So,
sure.
So I would say, not so much for these other second pulses, but generally speaking, any of those technologies. That's why I gave the example. For example, the example on the CO, carbon monoxide oxidation, right, which you have in a catalytic converter, right. There's a lot of questions: is what limits the effectiveness? What limits the effectiveness of any catalytic reaction which we are doing, right? And having these X-ray laser pulses, X-ray free electron laser pulses, can be used to understand such mechanisms. And once you understand the mechanism, you can then modify the way how you do the work, the chemistry work.
Great question, Carolyn, and thank you for asking it, because it may be something that would be worked up in the future and we could understand it better through this science. Professor Bergman, Steve emailed to ask you to comment on what sort of instruments you use to measure the timing of the events described in the attosecond realm, which, you know, I keep thinking of as what would be an instant to me. How do you measure that instant?
Yeah, so we, in our work, we have not measured it directly in the time domain. We have inferred to it from this broadening, which I had mentioned. So we there are now so-called streaking cameras, very complicated streaking cameras, and they have been used for softer X-ray work, for the ultraviolet work and for some of the softer work. They have been able to develop some instruments. We are thinking of maybe in the future developing an instrument where we can measure it directly in time. For our work, that has not been done. What we did is we showed that the only way the pulses can be as broad, no other way the pulse can be as broad other than being very, very short. So we did do an indirect measurement of that time.
I had a caller who didn't stay with us but wanted to know if another application of your research could be possibly treating neurodegenerative diseases.
Well, treating is one way.
Okay.
Understanding is another way.
Yes.
So I would always say, and by the way, synchrotron X-rays, even like the structure of the coronavirus, right, the COVID-19, has been done. They use the synchrotron to solve that structure, and a lot of research in medication and how to treat diseases comes from understanding how the affected molecular structure looks like, right? And so we are not in the business of treating. We are in the business of seeing and understanding how these things look like. And then with that information, one can go into a pharmaceutical company or a doctor could then devise a method of treatment, right? So we are not, we are one level removed from the application. We are more in the question of showing it how it looks like and understanding it, and then another team of researchers can do the work of developing a drug, for example, or a treatment.
I was curious, Professor Bergman, you had mentioned that Stoughton had one of the first synchrotron X-ray accelerators in the world until 2014. I'm wondering what happened to the synchrotron in Stoughton and whether or not you have the technology here in Wisconsin to move forward with your work.
Oh, yeah. So it's a really good question. Stoughton had, it was at long wavelengths, actually. So it was more like extreme ultraviolet and soft X-rays. But it had two rings and there was an upgrade. And, you know, like every of those research projects, I mean, it has a certain lifetime. And in 2014, I think there were other facilities around the world and around the country with more competitive properties, and that was the end of the lifetime. But Wisconsin has been pioneering, right? And they have a very strong history, and even a lot of Wisconsin scientists use these other facilities around the world and have made leading contributions to these other facilities. So there are now a lot of smaller tabletop instruments.
Huh.
They are not as powerful, but they are real. So we have, for example, in my lab, I have one in Wisconsin, which can do femtosecond pulses, right? And it doesn't do them with hard X-rays. It doesn't do them with extreme ultraviolet light, right? And they're not as powerful, but they are also extremely powerful in studying material science and chemical reactions. Right?
Uwe, I want to apologize because we are out of time for this hour, but I want to thank you for a fascinating discussion and sharing your research with us and our audience today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Uwe Bergmann, professor at the UW-Madison Department of Physics and researcher at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. Coming up next hour, the weather guys are back. Steve Ackerman and John Martin join us to answer your weather questions. What have you been seeing in the Wisconsin skies? I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to WPR News.